We're all aware of rising oceanic temperatures. Well, there's one particular stretch of water where the temperature is rising very, very alarmingly. It's the South China Sea, but we're not talking climate change. We're talking a change in the political climate. And we return to those troubled and troubling waters shortly. I'm just looking at a stack of figures here from the UNHCR. And it looks as though the current count of refugees on our planet is over 60 million. That includes internally displaced people. A lot of boats to turn back. And a little later, we're going to have an international discussion on this most international of issues. Looking at the South China Sea begs the question, what is the end game with China busily provoking the neighbourhood by island building and America's equally provocative reaction and flashing its new combat ship and patrol aircraft? We seem to be looking at a collision course. The Americans have described China's effort at island building in the shoals and reefs of the Spratlys as China's Great Wall of Sand. So does China want total control over the whole of the sea, or is it, as it claims, protecting its territorial rights and fishing fleets? You'll recall that last year China moved an oil drilling rig into waters off Vietnam, and that sparked anti-Chinese riots and shocked the Hanoi government. The South China Sea happens to be one of the world's busiest shipping thoroughfares and an important maritime link between the Pacific and Indian Oceans. In addition, Taiwan, Malaysia, Brunei, Philippines and Vietnam all border the sea. It also claims sovereignty over scattered islands and reefs. Where are we heading? I'm delighted to be joined in Sydney by Hamish McDonald, former foreign editor with the Sydney Morning Herald, and now Hamish is with, of course, the Saturday paper. Welcome back, Hamish. From the Hi. UK, we hear the voice of Bill Hayton. Bill recently joined us to discuss the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, a correspondent with BBC News. Bill's the author of The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. Thanks for coming back, Bill. And in our Melbourne studio, Mr. Shu Shindawa, who's a visiting fellow with the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. And at home, he works with China Radio International. Bill, the value of one and a half million square miles of water would appear to be inestimable. If China were to control it, what would it be gaining?
Well, I think there are some things which are tangible and some things that are intangible. I mean, there's a lot of fish in that sea, and there's a lot of people in China to feed, but there are also people in Vietnam, the Philippines, and other countries that need to eat the same fish. There's a certain amount of oil, although a lot less than Chinese have to think. Most of that oil is firmly on the continental shelves of the other countries around the edge of the sea.
Bill, you're breaking up. Bill, sorry, you're breaking up very badly. I'm going to put you back to Sydney. I'm not in Sydney, incidentally. While we try talking to Hamish, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, Brunei, Philippines also claim ownership of these waters. Do these countries have strong grounds, A, for their claims, and B, for concern?
Yeah, I think they do have strong claims. The Chinese claim based on the so-called nine-dash line is a very recent one. It has very little historical backing, although obviously Chinese boats have been operating around the South China Sea like everyone else's for a long time. These Southeast Asian countries do have an interest in getting a share of the seabed resources, the oil and gas, and the fishing. They all like their fish and prawns.
U.S. Defense Secretary Carter said last week at the Shangri-La Dialogue, I love that title, that the United States will fly, sail and operate wherever international law allows and will not be deterred from exercising these rights. How far will they push this, Hamish?
I think they will push it very hard. They are planning to sail and fly within what would be a 12-mile territorial claim around any of these artificial islands to assert that simply building an island on top of a reef that's submerged at low tide or an uninhabited island doesn't create a territorial zone or economic zone around it. Equally, I think the Chinese will try to assert such a claim gradually. So there is the potential for a clash here. Once America and its allies like Japan and Australia try to exercise that right to sail close or fly close. And then the Chinese, have awakened the nationalist dragon back home with the internet already clamouring in China for the Chinese PLA to stand up, to start, you know, flexing muscle and sending up fighters to tackle the American intruders.
Before I bring Mr. Hsu into the discussion, I'm going back to you, Bill. I believe we've got a slightly better connection. We were talking about the fish, we're talking about the oil, but of greater importance, I would guess, would be the domination of sea lanes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, something like half of world trade goes through the Straits of Malacca and across the South China Sea. It's not just China, it's South Korea, it's Taiwan, it's Japan, and then across the Pacific to the US as well. So huge amounts of trade. And you just think about how much stuff in general is produced around the South China Sea. All those sort of computers coming out of Chinese factories and shoes and clothes and many other things. And then I think the other thing you've got to put in is this, the intangible idea that, you know, that this is Chinese territory, which, I mean, I argue very strongly that this is a sort of an invention very much of the 20th century, but that doesn't mean that it's not strongly believed by people on the street in China and the leadership, and anything that tries to sort of tackle the problems in the South China Sea, I think it has to wrestle with this idea that Chinese school children, you know, to this day are taught that the South China Sea belongs to China, and they're not taught the other side of the argument, and that makes it a very emotional issue for lots of people.
Bill, I'm reading your material. There's you argue that the arguments or the interest in the waters by the Chinese are fourfold. Yes, that sense of historical entitlement, national prestige. You talk about the need for strategic depth to protect China's coastal cities. Mm-hmm. Talk to that briefly, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, the idea, I think, that, I mean, China, for, you know, long historical reasons, you know, ever since the British showed up in 1840 and forced them to open their ports at the barrel of a gun, has sort of felt that the danger comes from the sea. And, you know, given that the vast majority of China's wealth is now created in ports around its coast, the sense of vulnerability that it would need to keep foreigners and other enemies, potential enemies, away from the coast in order to protect the cities and protect the industry and the people that are based there. But then going beyond that, this sort of sense that it doesn't really trust the international community, however you define that, to protect the trade routes. And increasingly you're seeing China as trying to actually physically guard trade routes, you know, into the Middle East, to its sources of oil and to Africa and to its markets, and no longer being prepared to trust the international community or the U.S. Navy to do it on its behalf. And so that's why we're sort of seeing, I think, this clash as China tries to step up to a regional and potentially a global role, and that is clashing with the U.S.'s historic role since the Second World War. But specifically in the South China Sea, it's the way that China is trying to claim ownership of the sea as a piece of territory, which is bumping into the United States and the other countries in the region, because that's not happening anywhere else in the world, only really in the South China Sea.
Let's bring Chin Do-wo in now. And in spite of how it all looks, I understand that you argue that China is actually quite a late comer to this game of laying claims. For example, Taiwan has occupied the largest island in the sea.
That's right. Phillips, thank you for the invitation here. Can I give a brief history, a little bit of history about, whether China has the grounds to claim the South China Sea? Of course, both Vietnam and China claimed their ownership of South China Sea based on the historical, evidence. But, most experts don't believe in that because that's the concept actually before the modern concept of sovereignty came into being in recent recent times. And then in 1884-1885, Sino-French war over there, the war was caused actually by the French effort to incorporate the Paracel and Spratly Sea into the French Indochina. So China opposed to that move, and then there was a war. Since that time, China, every Chinese government have made maps to show their ownership of South China Sea. And then let's move fast forward to 1945, when Japan was defeated, when Chinese government, as KMT, Republic of China, accepted the surrender of Taiwan, of Japan. Actually, that's Taiwan. At that time, Japan made Spratly and Paracel as part of Taiwan. So they returned Taiwan and the South China Sea to China. And that was actually assisted by the United States at the end of the Second World War. And in 1946 and 1947, the Republic of China, the previous government, they made a map, the so-called 11 dash line. That's a map. They announced the map to the international community, and there was no opposition. And then there was a civil war in China. So the communist government basically defeated the Republic of China, or the KMT, and they moved to Taiwan. So the Beijing government inherited the nine-dash line map. And it clearly says Spratly and also the Paracel is part of China, the Chinese territory. But the problem appeared in 1970s, actually. In 1950, I think it's 55, the North Vietnam government even officially, publicly announced their recognition of Paracel and Spratly as part of China. But when the North Vietnam and the South Vietnam united in 1979, I believe, and then they adopted the South Vietnamese position. That is they have also claimed ownership of these islands. And then they sent people to the islands, and then they expelled the Chinese fishermen from the waters close to Paracel Islands. And then there was a brief military clash between China and Vietnam at that time. And then you would see the Spratly, mostly. I think it's 44 islands or islets. Vietnam occupied 24 of them, and the Philippines, 8, China, 7. So both Vietnamese and the Philippines, they occupied the island and sent, expanded, reclaimed the land for the islands.
So what China's doing now has recent precedent. Yes, Hamish, do so.
This is Bill Hagen.
Oh.
Can I jump in? I mean, I wanted to give your guest a chance to say his piece, but I would say that almost every single thing he said there was incorrect on a simple matter of evidence.
This was not my version. This is actually the U.S. diplomat, the U.S. former U.S. ambassador.
Well, I don't know how much of a history discussion you want, but let's start from the beginning. The war between France and China was nothing to do with the Paris and Spratly Islands back in the 1880s. It was about a land border. It was about Tonkin, which only applies to the northern part of Vietnam, not to the southern or the central part. Moving ahead, the Chinese did not accept the surrender of the Japanese forces on the islands. They didn't get there until a year after the Japanese had surrendered to the Americans. The Vietnamese government did not recognize the territorial claim in 1958. They recognized a maritime decree. We can keep on going forward and forward, but I don't know how much of a historical argument you want to have.
Well, I thought we were going to settle all these matters tonight and hand back to a much more peaceful world. Hamish, would you like to comment?
Well, yeah, I would tend to pick some holes in Jindor's historical account myself. I think it was the South Vietnamese who were kicked out of the Paracels by the Chinese in 1974. But I think we're looking at the nitty-gritty of territorial claims, and I don't think that's the main American interest or the Chinese interest. I think the Chinese want to create a kind of Mare Nostrum to keep the American Navy at bay. As Bill said, they want space around their coast, and as they extend their strategic power into a global reach, they want to be able to break out from an American blockade, which has been there essentially since 1945.
Let's change the emphasis slightly. Chinduwo, last month, Beijing's Communist Party paper Global Times said that China might have to, quote, accept the possibility of conflict with the US if the United States' bottom line is that China has to halt its activities, then a US-China war is inevitable. Is Beijing serious about this, or is it theatricals?
No, Philip, I don't think there's a war. I don't even think there will be a military conflict between China and the United States, because there was too much at stake. You know, for China, they are preparing, for both countries, China and the U.S., they are preparing for a senior economic conference upcoming in June. And also in September, the Chinese President Xi Jinping is going to visit Washington. So neither side want to scupper the visit, want to damage the overall relationship. Remember, this confrontation between China and the U.S. in the South China Sea is only part of the overall relationship, which I would say, especially trade and economic relationship, which is very, very strong. You know, the overall trade between the two countries is $600 billion, U.S. dollars. So I don't think, you know, people want to take a risk to basically damage that relationship. And also, you know, for the U.S., if the U.S., you know, if you take a look at the speech given by Defense Secretary, U.S. Defense Secretary Carter in Shangri-La Dialogue, you know, his response, his, you know, attitudes is quite measured. You know, he basically called for the halt of activities from all claimants, you know.
Well, I'm glad that someone's response is measured. Bill, can I go back to you? How does China's attempt to extend control over the water go against or with the international law of the sea?
Well, the problem is there's different bits of international law here. There's the law of the sea, which you mentioned, which was approved by pretty much all countries back in 1982. China has ratified it, as of most countries, and the United States is one of a very small number of countries that has signed it but not ratified it. And that sets rules about, you know, if you have an island, i.e. if it's a piece of rock that is dry at high tide and you can stand on it, then it makes it an island. If you can then, and you get a 12 nautical mile sea around it, if you can live on that island, if it's suitable for human habitation, you get the territorial sea, and then you get up to 200 nautical miles of exclusive economic zone around it. And you measure that from coasts or from habitable islands. So the one question would be, you know, which of the features in the Spratlys are rocks, which would be underwater at high tide, and which are proper islands, as you and I would imagine an island would look like, and you get different zones from those. Some of the things that China occupies in the Spratlys are above water at high tide, a couple of them, but most would be underwater naturally at high tide. So they'll only exist because they're artificial islands. So you wouldn't be able to measure any zones from those. But what sometimes China argues is that an older version of history of international law based on, you know, discovery and conquest and stuff gives China the right to claim the entire sea, not just the islands. And that's the point of conflict.
Hamish, we're quite obsessed in Australia with submarines, which reminds me that these tensions are creating an arms race. Submarine production is skyrocketing, as is electronic anti-submarine warfare. Is there enough talk to your liking about de-escalation of this situation?
Well, it's certainly being escalated a lot. Everyone is buying submarines. Most of the Southeast Asians, including Vietnam. China has built a huge submarine port on Hainan Island. The Americans are sailing their surveillance ships right up to the 12 nautical mile limit around there, much to the anger of the Chinese. The Japanese are now have the defence guidelines modified so that they can patrol down into the South China Sea. Australia's new submarines are designed for long range, and no doubt our Defence Department would willingly send them up there to snoop around. So it's an area of great contestation for sea control.
Going back to you, Bill, you have written about a huge US surveillance ship, well, like the US Impeccable, whose job is to hunt Chinese submarines with a great long sensory cable it tows in its wake.
Yeah, I mean, the Impeccable is actually run by civilians, but it's part of the US Navy. And there are some other ships in the same sort of category. And they're trying to, you know, plan, you know, map the seabed and work out where Chinese submarines are going to go so that if there's ever a confrontation, they can track them. And, I mean, the problem with, you know, the United States has massive oceans on both of its coasts and, you know, open sea. The problem with China is that, unfortunately, plate tectonics has created a ring of islands all the way around its coast, you know, from Russia through Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, and down into Southeast Asia. And so the gaps in these islands are relatively small, and it's fairly easy for the Americans to put listening stations, you know, all around the region to try and monitor and control Chinese ship movements. And this is obviously something that bothers China enormously.
Hamish, this brings us to America's air-sea battle concept, which is all about maintaining access to shipping routes. I know it's top secret, and it isn't something that's even shared among its allies.
It's essentially a space-based concept of warfare that involves blinding your enemy pretty early in any conflict. And so the potential for escalation is quite high if America was to take out surveillance bases, ground stations, missile sites on the Chinese coast.
And this is at a time when Australia is opening its arms to American arms.
Well, the Australian military is increasingly locked into the American warfighting system through the doctrine of interoperability. The new air warfare destroyers, if they were deployed up in Southeast Asia, would essentially become robots to an American-controlled air defence system.
Hamish, you reported recently that it's possible the US and Japan have China cornered, not the other way around.
Well, certainly within the East China Sea and South China Sea, the so-called fishhook system of ocean surveillance, which has a network stretching down from the Tsushima Straits with Japan and Korea south along the Okinawa Islands across the Bashi Channel from Taiwan to the Philippines, and then in a loop through the Indonesian archipelago. This network of undersea microphones and magnetic anomaly detection systems and various other sensors would essentially track any submarine of China that attempted to break out into the open sea.
Chindo Wo, you've been listening quietly and patiently. Your response, please.
I think, you know, it's quite clear, you know, like China, U.S. says it does not take a position. It's not a claimant to the South China Sea disputes over there. But obviously, it has taken sides, you know, against China, together with the Philippines, together with the Vietnamese. They are almost trying to form alliance of like a NATO-like alliance in Asia. And since the announcement of the pivot to Asia in 2011, take a look at what the U.S. is doing. U.S. has basically been deploying like 60% of its naval force and air force up to, you know, until 2020 to this region. And of course, TPP, you know, we know TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is following a principle like ABC, anyone but China. So you can see there's a lot of suspicion from the Chinese side. You know, what's the, you know, intention of the United States, you know? So as we discussed previously by our guests about, you know, U.S., basically, it's like a containment of China. Basically, China was somehow tied down to the land and there's no way for them to move out. But China has to move out. probably. You know, it has interest around the world as the investment increases in Latin America, Africa, and European countries, and Middle East. And they have its people working around the world. So I don't know. I think, you know, China and the United States should sit down to talk about maybe a grand strategy, you know. Yes, you know, people look at history, you know, there's more conflicts probably, more risks between a rising power and a established power. But somehow, you know, from the Chinese side, you know, the option between China and the U.S. is the only one, that's peace. War is not never an option.
Bill, what are the regional security alliances being developed in this climate?
Well, it's not as simple as a NATO, that's for sure. I mean, the US has had a long-standing alliance with the Philippines, another one with Thailand, and it has and Japan. It has a sort of strange relationship with Taiwan. It has nothing at all with Vietnam, really, and sort of in between relationships with Indonesia and Malaysia. I mean, the odd thing for me is that if China wants to rise peacefully and avoid confrontation and everything, it simply needs to come out with all parts of its government and say, we recognize that UN law of the sea rules will apply to the South China Sea. We no longer claim the U-shaped line, i.e. all the waters that we have drawn within this line.
Well, Bill, can I answer your question there? Yeah, can I answer your question? You know, why China? You know, my understanding is like, I don't represent the Chinese government, but my guess is like, you know, all the, you know, the islands, either the islands or the South China Sea, you know, was basically is and not only considered by the Chinese mainland, but also by people in Taiwan. That's part of China. If the Chinese government somehow recognizes, you know, okay, we can give up the 24 islands or give up that island to the Philippines, to the Vietnamese, not only the public sentiment is hard to probably reconcile, but also people in Taiwan probably will criticize. If you take a look at the map from Taiwan and Beijing, they are exactly the same.
Okay, I want to put a final question to you, Hamish. Hamish, it seems to me that China and America are acting similarly, and they both seem to be under the impression of having a comparable exceptionalism.
Well, that's true. The Americans are pursuing, you know, the naval doctrine of Alfred Ahern, the pre-World War I naval Bismarck, as he was called, which is really to control the oceans right up to any potential enemy's coastline and dominate the seas. The Chinese, I think, hark back to their imperial times when they were surrounded by a ring of tributary states, and I think they're gradually trying to bring Japan, Korea, and the Southeast Asians back into that kind of subordinate role, as they've let slip at a few forums. So it is a clash of two exceptionalisms.
Gentlemen, I thank you. Hamish McDonald, world editor with the Saturday Paper. Bill Hayden, the author of The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. And Mr. Xu Xindewo, visiting fellow at the Asia Institute at Melbourne University. This is LNL. And after a little bit of music, Roger Zetter and Joseph Cairns join me to discuss refugee protection. No issue has concerned me or this program more than that of refugees over the last 25 years, and the crisis grows and grows and grows. According to the latest reports from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, 5.5 million people were forced to flee in the first half of 2014 alone. This was in addition to the 51 million people counted as refugees or as internally displaced persons at the end of 2013. You can confidently add some more millions to that figure, so you are now looking at 60 million. It was Syrians who became the largest population of refugees at 3 million last year, and it's the countries that can least afford it who are taking this people in. Now, as the number of refugees and the internally displaced continues to rise worldwide, what's the best way to respond to the situation long term? Joining me on Skype from Oxford is Roger Zetter. Roger is Emeritus Professor of Refugee Studies at the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford. In the Sydney studio, we have Joseph Cairns. Joe is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto. His most recent book is The Ethics of Immigration. And Joe is here as a professorial fellow at the Catholic University's Institute for Social Justice. Gentlemen, I welcome you to our little wireless program. Roger, as someone who's been working in the area of refugee studies for many, many years, let me ask you this. Has there been a time in human history where so many people are on the move? What was the situation, for example, at the end of World War II?
The numbers at the end of World War II were certainly substantially less than this. And, of course, the other critical difference was that they were very substantially confined to Europe, Central Europe and Eastern Europe. I think the crucial difference now is the global spread, really, of the refugee phenomenon. And as you rightly pointed out in the introduction, the absolutely vast numbers. Because, of course, what you didn't mention is that besides the official numbers you mentioned of internally displaced people and the statistics on refugees collected by UNHCR, there are probably millions more who are undocumented, who cross borders without papers, who for a variety of reasons are not registered as refugees. So the number is absolutely absolutely without precedent. We can look back to the 1990s when there was very large displacement in Africa, although quite a lot of millions of refugees have repatriated there. But certainly in the 60 or so years since UNHCR started and the 1951 convention was ratified, I think the numbers are indeed unprecedented.
And for whatever people, reason people are forced out of their homes, they're seeking protection, and they're not getting much, are they?
No. I think many experts and certainly many people in the humanitarian field recognize that what we're facing now are an increasing series of so-called protection gaps and the diminishing scale of protection space. In other words, it's increasingly difficult for people to access basic human rights enshrined in international law, the right to seek asylum and the right to have that request for asylum treated with dignity.
Well, our own government, of course, is walking away from its international obligations, and this is bipartisan, indeed tripartisan. Now, you argue that there needs to be a rethink of the 1951 Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees and the 67 Protocol. But even in the past, they didn't really provide the protection they were designed to do.
No, this is true, because the nature of the protection afforded was under very specific conditions of persecution. And I think certainly in the contemporary situation, it is very hard to prove on an individual basis that you have been or you are susceptible to persecution, because what we see now are an increasingly complex series of drivers that force people from their homes, from their habitats, from their local economies. And the challenge, I think, for receiving countries, the challenge for the international community, is to think about the ways in which protection has to extend beyond a simple, or a relatively simple as it seems, status of the refugee, to a much broader protection of rights of people who are fleeing a variety of drivers of displacement, conflict, climate change, and the like.
Well, I'm glad you've mentioned climate change, because the scale of displacement is very likely to increase by orders of magnitude. Joe, are countries like Australia, the US, Canada, and some in Europe justified in refusing entry to refugees?
Well, I don't think so. The example I always use here is that the current refugee regime was created in the shadow of the Holocaust, and the democratic countries said, we'll never again allow this. And yet, as I think Roger has pointed out, the same phenomenon is going on, that Jews fleeing Hitler were turned away, and all of the arguments that you hear today about why rich countries want to turn away refugees and the methods that they use, visa controls, carrier sanctions, these were all methods that were used to turn away Jews fleeing Hitler. So I think there's a moral failure here.
Well, the largest moral failure on the planet, I think. But so you agree with Roger that we're absolutely failing?
Absolutely.
What should we do, Joe?
Well, here you'd have to distinguish between what we should do and what we're likely to do. So I agree, for example, with Roger that the existing Geneva Convention definition of a refugee is not very good, but I think it would be a mistake to try to change it, because if we try to open that up, it's going to get narrowed and not expanded in the way that would be desirable.
And I'm sorry, I don't quite understand what you just said. Run that past me again.
Well, Roger was saying, I thought, that a system based on individualized protection won't adequately cope with the refugee problems that we face today, which have complex causes, and it's very difficult to prove that an individual is a refugee. That's a mistake to organize the whole system around that. And I think that's right. But his view and my view is that what's morally required is a more expansive system of refugee protection. I just don't see the political impetus for that expanded protection. And I'm worried that any attempt to fiddle with the existing system will lead to a narrowing of protection, not an expansion of it.
One of the things that has shocked me ever since Tampa, well, before Tampa, is the way our government and other governments are now echoing this, talk about, queue jumpers, for example, illegals. Jumping the queue is, of course, a nonsense where there is very often no queue to jump.
Exactly. So I think that's exactly right. I just watched this terrific documentary, Leaky Boat, which made that point very effectively. That and it's very rare that it's not to say there are never any people who claim to be refugees who might not qualify even under an expanded definition, but it is fair to say that what the rich states are doing is making every effort to keep out people who they know are genuine refugees. And I thought, if I can just say one other thing, your point at the beginning, it's the poor countries who are taking them in. That's, I think, an important point. There's a failure of responsibility here. We're willing to let the poorest, much poorer countries bear the burden of taking care of the refugees.
The political consequences, Roger, are calamitous almost everywhere. We know how ultra-right parties are flourishing all over the planet as a consequence of being able to beat the drums of fear. They were of some significance even in the last UK elections.
Indeed, they were. And just to bear out the point that Joseph just made, I mean, one listens to the political rhetoric, but the reality is that of those 60-plus million that you talked about in your introduction, well over 95% of people who are forcibly displaced are in the global south, in largely speaking poor or lower to middle income countries who have a great problem in carrying that burden. Our response in Europe, your response in Australia, response in Canada and the US, I think is really absolutely minimal, both in terms of accepting and resettling, even on a temporary basis, those who I think have a very legitimate claim. And I think in terms of seeking longer term political and economic solutions to the impact that refugees have on host economies. Let's bear in mind that this sort of criminalization of those seeking refugee status is exactly as Joseph said. It's the result of more and more of a Fortress Europe mentality, the notion of pushback. And if one just looks at the figures in the first 6 months of this year, those crossing the Mediterranean, as you know, this has become a global issue, but an issue specifically for Europe. The vast majority of those people are not economic migrants. They are fleeing countries that are in conflict or where there are very severe abuses of human rights.
You know, the other night we were discussing the passing of, well, not so long ago, we were discussing the passing of Malcolm Fraser. I had many a disagreement with him, but he was remarkably good on the Vietnamese problem at the end of the so-called American War. And we did a program the other night where it was pointed out to us that of the 1.5 million Vietnamese who fled the country after the fall of Saigon 50 years ago, usually in little boats, you know, designed for placid rivers, it's up to 500,000 of them died. So what we have here, I put this to you, Joe, is in our neighbourhood a catastrophe of immense dimensions. More recently, of course, we had the CivEx, which at the time I thought was going to completely change Australian attitudes to and hostility to boat people, but it didn't. Our hearts have got ever harder.
Well, actually, it's interesting. That was exactly the phrase for which I was going to reach. There was a time when Australia and Canada and the United States took pride in being havens for people fleeing desperate straits, and all of that seems to have disappeared. And now it just seems a hardening of the hearts where as you said at the beginning, people can make political capital out of getting tough on refugees. It's perplexing, it's depressing, but it does seem to be the political reality.
Roger, there's a parallel between law and order elections. I don't think they've been as bad in the UK as they've been here, but almost every state politician sees political advantage of being ever tougher on crime. And this is the same sort of political phenomenon.
Yes, I think it is this process of stigmatizing the other, stigmatizing the stranger, the fear that refugees, asylum seekers are going to be taking our jobs and so on. But, I mean, the reality is if you take the European Union, a union of something in the order of 500 million people, there are probably not more than about a million, million and a half refugees. If we take the case of Britain, something in the order of about 20 to 25,000 people a year claim refugee status. Not many get it, even through processes of appeal and tribunals and so on. So the numbers we're talking about in terms of those claiming a humanitarian status and, as you say, a humane response from us is really just a decimal point of a percentage. And the reality is that, as we know and as countless research studies show, refugees are net contributors to national economies, to local economies.
This is, it's LNL, but tonight it's AlienL, and I'm discussing the increasing global refugee crisis with Joseph Cairns from the University of Toronto and Roger Zetta from Oxford. Roger, your own work in Cyprus should be discussed now, because you showed how a major disaster of conflict and displacement could be turned into a development opportunity.
Yes, indeed. This was following the Turkish invasion in 1974, when 40% of the population were displaced internally. I mean, they were not refugees, although they adopted the label refugees, they were technically internally displaced, but 40% of the population, just imagine that in the context of Australia or the UK, a huge number of people were displaced. But what the government of the island did on the southern side, the Greek Cypriot government, it was to use that disaster as a development opportunity to reconstruct the economy of the country through a massive housing program. And within about 10 to 12 years, three-year emergency development plans, the economy had largely been re-established. Large-scale, massive unemployment had been very substantially diminished. And really on that basis, part of my argument now and a lot of my research in the last few years has been trying to develop a new response, a longer-term response to refugee crises, where we see these undoubted short-term challenges and enormous burdens on countries like Lebanon and Jordan at the current time can be turned into potential long-term development opportunities.
Joe, back to you. One of the things you've been writing about is what rights regular or irregular immigrants should have once they settle in a country. What are the ethics and morals authorities should be considering?
Well, I think what we have to recognize is that once people arrive and settle in a country, over time they become members of the society. And even when they first arrive, whether they've arrived with legal authorization or not, they have some basic human rights that governments have to respect, after all. Just because a person has arrived without authorization doesn't mean they can be shot down in the streets or robbed or beaten up or and so on. The police still have to protect them.
But would such a... It would be argued by people who want to turn back the boats and harden hearts that such a policy might have an incentive effect.
Well, there's always an issue of incentives, but I think the in practical terms, this fear of creating an incentive by treating people decently is mistaken. As Roger said, the drivers of this forced migration is that they're very complex, they're multifarious, and the incentive effect is only one tiny factor.
If I could comment on that, I mean, the evidence from the Mediterranean precisely proves that point. We had the so-called Mare Nostrum, which was the search and rescue at sea, and a lot of the European politicians said, well, we're being too soft, this is an encouragement, so we'll have Operation Triton, which was in 2014. And what happened? Exactly the same numbers of those who were trying to cross the Mediterranean continued through a stricter regime as through a so-called more liberal incentivizing regime. And the result is, as you know, we've now got a Mare Nostrum, a much more humane, humanitarian search and rescue policy back in force now. So the idea that somehow being soft on immigration and somehow having relatively open borders is going to be an incentive, I think, just does not stand up to the evidence.
You know, it's interesting. There's another parallel here, or a related idea, and that is the argument that capital punishment is a great deterrent and will lower crime rates. There's absolutely no evidence of that happening anywhere. Australia abandoned capital punishment years ago, and I think we're in rather a better shape in regard to prison populations per capita than say the United States. So in a way, Joe, your ethical concerns don't begin and end, or can't begin and end, simply on refugees. There's got to be a much wider sense of communal morality.
That's right. I think the challenge here is to see refugees and other immigrants as people who come to belong over time, who, as Roger said, contribute to the community when they're present, and who should be welcomed and included. And if we take that basic approach to immigration generally, of course there'll be some adaptation by the refugees and other immigrants. The people who come to a new country, they have responsibilities, but they also have legitimate moral claims. And if they're treated with open arms, everybody will benefit. I think the general challenge from a moral point of view is the sort of thing that Roger was talking about, is trying to show people that actually the conflict between doing the right thing, which is certainly welcoming refugees especially and other immigrants as well, and our own collective interests is not great, especially if we take a long-term perspective.
Come back in, Roger.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think the immediate challenge we face, I think, is partly reshaping the political agendas of Europe, Australia, Canada, US, and so on. The developed economies reshaping the kind of moral response and the humanitarian response on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think recognizing that, as you said in your introduction, countries in the Middle East now having to absorb a phenomenal number of Syrian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and so on. There are immediate short-term pressures there on those countries, on the national economies, on social relations, simply because the numbers are so vast. I mean, one in four people living in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee now.
Yeah.
Imagine that kind of percentage in Australia or in the UK. And the fact of the matter is that unless we provide a really substantial both humanitarian and developmental response, the spillover effects of disaffected populations are going to affect us globally. So it's in our interests, from all perspectives, I think, to adopt a much more proactive and humane response.
Now, Joe, you're being a provocateur. You're mounting an argument for open borders to get listeners and politicians thinking. Tell us what it is.
Well, so you should understand this argument is not a policy proposal because I recognize it to be a non-starter, but I want people to think about the situation in which we find ourselves. And to me, it seems a lot like this, like the modern world is organized a lot like feudalism. So under feudalism, there were a few people born into the nobility. The vast majority of the people were born into the peasantry, and they were locked into their class positions. Well, in the modern world, being born into a rich state in Europe or North America or Australia, New Zealand, is a lot like being born into the nobility, even if some of us are lesser nobility. And being born into a poor state in the global south is a lot like being born into the peasantry. That's where the vast majority of humankind is. And the closure of borders, keeping people from moving, just as under feudalism, keeps people in their place. Now, this is not the natural order of things. People just take it for granted. But if you ask, the whole way we've organized the world is a human construction. And we have to say, what justifies that? People in Australia, Canada, if they were on the other side, why would they think this set of arrangements is fair? And what makes it legitimate? And I think it isn't, clearly, if you think about that, and that it ought to be transformed. There should be much more equality within the world as a whole and much more freedom to move.
I think also, in addition to the moral imperative, which I think Joseph has articulated very powerfully, there is the economic imperative as well, that the consequence of globalization is simply that we now have the free movement of investment, the free movement of capital. But the one thing that we are totally resistant to is the free movement of labor. And that really is underlying a lot of the pressure, if you like, or the drivers for international migration. And we have to remember that a substantial amount of migration is actually south-south migration. We have this kind of paranoia in the north, and I suppose the southern hemisphere as well, as of developed countries, that somehow that we're facing a kind of migration crisis from south to north. In fact, substantially, a lot of the migration is south-south anyway. But it is, in the broader terms, the consequence of the policies of globalization which were adopted in the 1980s.
Gentlemen, thank you. I've been talking to Roger Zetter, Emeritus Professor of Refugee Studies at the Refugee Studies Centre at the University of Oxford, and to Joseph Cairns, Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto. And that's a wrap for the week. Thank you, team. Executive Producer Gail Basario, producers Kate McDonald and Ruth Aslee, Isabel Summerson, Annabel Quince, and on knobs, Joe Wallace and Marty Peralto. And let me once again thank Christine Short for her remarkable efforts for the Little Wireless program over the last 20 of her 38 years at the ABC.